From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the eve of the California recall election, the Golden State feels edgy and more than a little ornery tonight, wrapped once again in its own special providence and its consequences. Novelist, essayist, and native Californian Joan Didion is not sure the state has ever properly understood itself. Now she's challenging its founding mythology. Tonight on Point, Joan Didion reconsiders California. But first, to paraphrase the old show tune, California, here they come. Tomorrow, Californians go to the polls to vote on whether to recall Democratic Governor Gray Davis and replace him with someone else. In the final hours before the vote, Davis and Republican frontrunner Arnold Schwarzenegger have come out swinging hard at each other, and in the case of Schwarzenegger, against charges of sexual harassment leveled by 15 women. Tim Grieve is senior writer for Salon.com and has been covering the recall. I asked him what the polls are showing about a likely outcome.
Well, it depends a lot upon which poll you look at. The major published polls still show a major chasm between Davis's survival and his ouster.
And what do you mean exactly there about that chasm, Tim?
Well, the polls show overwhelmingly that Davis will be recalled, but those polls also are tightening a bit as the race goes closer and the allegations about Arnold Schwarzenegger's past behavior come out.
So it's a two-part vote, and the polls say, at least they have over the past few days, people will vote, yes, we want this governor recalled. On the other side stand all the many challengers with Schwarzenegger at the lead. How does he stand?
Yeah, he still stands virtually in every poll in the lead on that question, probably 37, 29, something like that, Schwarzenegger over the Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante.
So if the recall is approved, Arnold stands to take the governor's seat.
That's certainly how it looks, although Democrats will tell you quietly, and sometimes not so quietly, their polling numbers show things a little tighter than that, and that the allegations about Schwarzenegger are starting to hit home. You certainly wouldn't get a sense of that talking to Republicans, however.
Meaning they're not shaken by the revelations about sexual harassment of women and his comments about Adolf Hitler?
If they're shaken, they're certainly not letting on. I was at a Schwarzenegger rally at the state capitol in Sacramento yesterday and talked to a number of Schwarzenegger supporters who, after hearing about the allegations, said things like, well, nobody's perfect. These are the kinds of things that people do in Hollywood, and this is all dirty politics at the last minute by Gray Davis. They just don't seem to put a lot of credence in them, and even if they do put credence in the allegations, they just don't seem to think they matter.
We heard Schwarzenegger's initial response where he said he was sorry and he apologized if he had offended anyone last week. How is he handling the issue as the poll comes closer?
Well, it's interesting. He had that initial apology, and it wasn't really clear entirely what he was admitting or not admitting, but he seemed to be generally admitting that the allegations were true. Now he's backtracked a bit. He made the rounds on some of the news programs over the weekend and said that some of these things sound like me, but that some of them are definitely not true, but he wouldn't really say which was which. And he ended up saying, as soon as the campaign is over, I can get into all of these specifics. Well, of course, no one's going to be all that interested once the campaign is over. People are keenly interested right now.
Where does it appear that the stories have come from? Has this all been dug up by Enterprise reporting, by the LA Times and others, or have these women come forward on their own? Have they been pushed forward?
The LA Times says that the women were not pushed forward, that the Times was not led to people by the Davis campaign. The Schwarzenegger people are obviously suspicious of that, but so far at least the LA Times is saying that the Times, found these people on its own.
Tim, when voters say they want to vote for Arnold Schwarzenegger, what is it that they're voting for? What does he stand for in their minds?
That's a really good question, and I've talked to a lot of Schwarzenegger voters, and frankly, they sometimes don't really seem to know. They say things like, he has a lot of new ideas, or he'll treat California like a business. But if you ask that follow-up question of, what new ideas appeal to you, or what does it mean to treat California like a business, you get that deer in the headlights kind of look. It's hard not to think they support him because they know who he is. He's famous. He's a movie star. And most important, he's not Gray Davis.
Does he put out an agenda of steps that he's prepared to take in his first months in office? The pressures there are very keen.
Only in the vaguest possible sense. He actually held a speech in Sacramento about a week ago in which he sort of outlined his first 100 days. But they're really things like, on day one, I will appoint an auditor to look at the state's financial system. They're not, by and large, very concrete and specific steps.
So when the political classes in California look at this whole race, how do they interpret it? Do they say, well, this is like when actor Ronald Reagan came to power in California, or does this look like something new, something different?
I don't think anybody really knows what to make of it. There's so many strange things going on here. You've got the star power of Schwarzenegger. You have the really visceral dislike that people have for Gray Davis on both ends of the political spectrum. Davis doesn't really have any friends among Democrats, and he certainly has no friends among Republicans. So it's in many ways easy to think this is a one-time-only sort of situation. On the other hand, it's not entirely unlike Florida. It's not entirely unlike Texas. And a lot of Democrats are saying this is, you know, another attempt by the Republicans to grab through other means an election they couldn't win in a straightforward way.
Sort of a roundabout through the recall, and yet ultimately it is in the voters' hands.
That's right. It's in the voters' hands, and we'll see tomorrow night what happens. If we have an answer tomorrow night with 135 candidates on the ballot, it may take some time to sort this thing out.
What are they saying about that? How long could it go?
They're saying it could take days or maybe even weeks to count all the votes. I think most people since will have a pretty clear idea of what's going to happen by the end of the night tomorrow, but who knows? This thing has been hard to pull. People don't have models for how to really imagine how this is going to work. They really have no idea what the turnout is going to be. The polling places have been put together in a hurry. There's just not a lot of basis to make good predictions about how this thing is going to play out.
Tim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tim Grieve is senior writer for Salon.com. He spoke with me from San Francisco. Joan Didion's continent-crossing ancestors came early to California. The state and its state of mind have figured prominently in the life work of the celebrated novelist and essayist. Now at 69, Joan Didion is turning around to fundamentally reconsider California, from its founding mythologies to her own family's role to her own writing on the state. In a new memoir, Where I Was From, she challenges all of it, demanding a reassessment of what California was and is. Tonight, on the eve of a stranger-than-fiction recall vote, Joan Didion on California. What does California stand for to you? And are you sure that's what it really is? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Joan Didion, author of the new memoir, Where I Was From. Good evening and welcome, Joan Didion.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Joan Didion.
Hello.
It's terrific to have you, Joan, and especially tonight when everyone's looking out toward California, but you're really taking a much longer view in the memoir, a fascinating read, enjoyed it enormously. You were raised deep in all of this California mythology. It was part of your family's lore and legend and stories handed down. And here you are kind of raising a fist up against so much of it. We want to hear all about that tonight, but I wondered if you would be good enough to jump in just from the top and perhaps read to us. Here's a point where it goes right back to when you were a girl, really, thinking and speaking out about California.
Quote, 100 years ago, our great-great-grandparents were pushing America's frontier westward to California, unquote. So began the speech I wrote to deliver at my eighth-grade graduation from the Arden School outside Sacramento. The subject was our California heritage. Developing a theme encouraged by my mother and grandfather, I continued, made rather more confident than I should have been by the fact that I was wearing a new dress, pale green organdy, and my mother's crystal necklace. Quote, they who came to California were not the self-satisfied, happy, and content, but the adventurous, the restless, and the daring. They were different even from those who settled in other western states. They didn't come west for homes and security, but for adventure and money. They pushed in over the mountains and founded the biggest cities in the west. Up in the mother lode, they mined gold by day and danced by night. San Francisco's population multiplied almost 20 times until 1906, when it burned to the ground and was built up again nearly as quickly as it burned. We had an irrigation problem, so we built the greatest dams the world has known. Now both desert and valley are producing food in enormous quantities. California has accomplished much in the past years. It would be easy for us to sit back and enjoy the results of the past. But we can't do this. We can't stop and become satisfied and content. We must live up to our heritage, go on to do better and greater things for California. Unquote. That was June 1948. The pale green of the organdy dress was a color that existed in the local landscape, only for the few spring days when the rice first showed. The crystal necklace was considered by my mother an effective way to counter the valley heat. Such was the blinkering effect of the local dream time that it would be some years before I recognized that certain aspects of our California heritage did not add up.
Joan Didion, reading from her new memoir, Where I Was From, and quoting from her own eighth grade speech, if I got that right?
Eighth grade, yes.
So then you were 12 or 13, something like that, I suppose. Now 69 or so, and looking back on 68, looking back on all of it, and at what doesn't add up, what is it? Yeah, I mean, the speech that you gave then is, you know, it's red, white, and blue California. Now mm-hmm. you look back and say, no. What are you saying no to, Jordan?
Well, I mean, just for example, I mean, we had an irrigation problem, so we built the greatest dams the world has known. Well, we didn't build them. The federal government built them. The rest of the country built them. And a whole lot of things that we thought we did as rugged individualists out there who hated the government and didn't want any part of the government were actually funded by the government. The Southern Pacific Railroad, the Central Pacific Railroad, the railroad was built by the federal government. The way the water moves in California was heavily funded by the government. Then, of course, we had the defense industry was totally a government contracts. And yet, as we see right now on the eve of the recall, people are talking about how much they hate all government. I mean, they're unhappy about, in this case, the state government, but they aren't any happier about the federal government.
It's a sweeping kind of sweeping out of myth that you do here. You come to it from a kind of position where I guess you're qualified. Your family's been there from very early on. What's the family history, Joan Didion?
Different branches came in different years. I think the first people to come were my mother's mother's family. They came in 1846. And others came up through 1852. These were people who had generally always lived on frontiers. I mean, since before the Revolution, they had lived on frontiers. They were a certain kind of American. I mean, there are a lot of them.
But the message in their character and what they did, you say quite pointedly in this book, is not what it was presented as being. Even to the crossing of the continent itself, which you describe as always being presented in redemptive terms,
the whole origin myth. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Some of your family actually came with the Donner Party that were reduced to cannibalism in those high passes. The idea that the difficulty of it brought men and women as new men and women into California. You say no.
That was the idea. That was certainly the promise. I mean, that was not only did you start over, you started over clean. It was crossing the Sierra was what was in the idea of the place. It had redeemed you. What happened then? I mean, it was only much later when people started asking each other, much later in each person's life, that they started. Certain people started asking each other or themselves, what was it that we were redeemed for? There wasn't a next step, you know. There wasn't a responsibility step. There wasn't a step you were redeemed to do this. It was straight redemption.
Jack Beatty, Joan Didion stood up early in her career and really planted a flag in the whole subject of California, made it her early meat, and now we've got a major reconsideration here.
Yes, and it set in early, even among the prospectors. I was recently reading letters from gold miners who were just full of disillusion, no finding no gold, finding Indians, finding death, finding disease, and saying, why did I ever come to California?
We're talking tonight with essayist and novelist Joan Didion about her personal reconsideration of her native state, California. You can join the conversation, what does California stand for to you? Today, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with essayist and novelist Joan Didion about her personal reconsideration of her native state, California. Her new memoir is Where I Was From. She's been writing novels and essays for a long time, celebrated on many fronts, but California's the native ground. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you hear in the reassessment of native daughter Joan Didion? If the California experiment was not so heroic, not redemptive, then what was it? What is it? And are all origin myths flawed, fluffed up? Is California a worse offender than any other creation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joan Didion, there's clearly a personal mission of a sort that you're on in this book, because you used so much right from eighth grade on that all the material of California in your early work. You're clearly going back to kind of set the record straight. But there seems to be a public mission here as well. Is there, and what is it?
Well, I think that this book is about the ways in which misunderstandings and confusion about my past specifically, but everybody's past, about who we were and what we did, why we did what we did. There's a point at which that gets in the way of any clear understanding of where we are now and where we can, you know, where we can go. So that was why I wanted to do it for myself. And really, when I got to the end of it, I had just raised more questions for myself. But I think generally there are a lot of confusions in everybody's mind about right now, about what America means, about what it's supposed to be, who we were as Americans, as well as whatever else we are.
And you're ready in Where I Was From to kick off from California, to extrapolate from California, take it right on out to the country.
I haven't taken it all the way.
No, you haven't. But yet, yet there's so much in here that you could stretch back east if you chose to. So here you describe legends that the facts don't live up to. But what are the consequences of a state that says we're self-made, we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, we were redeemed on the way across, government is nothing but trouble, and at the same time you're saying was not so redeemed, came confused, was constantly floated by the government in railroads and waterworks and aerospace and crop subsidies? What are the consequences of that kind of confusion over time, Joan Didion? And I guess, do you see them playing out in the very recall we're in the midst of right now?
Well, I do. The obvious consequences are that it gets in the way of your seeing things in any clear way. You're trapped in a narrative that doesn't really apply. I think that what we're seeing in the recall, in the case of California, we're talking about people who were careless from the very beginning. I mean, from the very beginning, they were careless people. They believed they could strike it rich. I mean, I thought that was an admirable thing in that commencement speech. You know, that they didn't come for homes or security. They came to get rich.
And you were raised to respect that as gumption.
Yes, exactly. And the carelessness now, I mean, you see it in two ways. One, they simply don't know how to deal with with the states not having enough money. They don't have a clue, that it's a more, that what has happened to the economy is more generous, is to some degree, not Gray Davis's fault. Mm-hmm. Whatever his his errors have been. It's not he's not totally responsible for this, but they aren't willing to buy that. They're careless about. So they think they'll send a message when they have no concern for the cause effect of it. I mean, they don't think that messages. I mean, they don't look ahead enough to see that messages have consequences. I mean, it's very hard to know what the consequences of this message will be if in fact there is a recall. I think some of the internal polling is showing.
Looks pretty likely now.
Well, some of the internal polling shows a little tightening.
Diminution. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, of the recall issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the bigger issue you're saying here is a state that's still, after all these years, or maybe because of the years, not to grips with itself and what it's really about.
It's not to grips with itself, no. And
the fundamental illusions, as you see them.
The fundamental illusions?
Mm-hmm.
The fundamental illusions are one, that we were redeemed and don't have to do anything further. That's one.
Just getting there was enough.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other one is that we have somehow earned everything we have by our individual efforts, when in fact we have been given it.
Jack Beatty, it's a remarkable moment, really, when a novelist and essayist, as celebrated of the standing of Joan Didion, turns around on her native ground and so publicly reconsiders a lot of what she stood on early on in a way that goes so deep. It makes you want to stand up and really pay attention.
Yes, it does. And if I might just say, Tom, I can still remember the day. I think it must have been in 1968 when a very young man, I picked up a copy of Slouching Towards Bethlehem in the bookstore and started to read the essay on John Wayne. And I can still remember my pleasure at that. And I just wanted to tell Ms. Didion how much her writing has always meant to me. But, Tom, let me say what California has meant to the nation. Mm. California has had a seismic effect on our politics. It was October 18, 1850, was a fateful day in 19th century history. That was the day the Speaker Oregon entered San Francisco Bay with a pennant flying, California is a state. California's admission to the Union, John C. Calhoun said, destroyed the equilibrium of the Union. The 31st star broke the balance of 15 slave and 15 free states. It made 16 free and 15 slaves. And that, the Bancroft, the historian of California, said, brought on, quote, the War of the Rebellion. That is to say, California was a poisoned cup. It brought on the Civil War. It helped set in train all the things that did that. And in the 20th century, it's upset equilibriums again, most notably in the tax revolt of the 1970s, which really happened in California first, but then happened all over the country and happened for more or less the same reason that confirmed in the census of 1990 that we are no longer a urban nation but a suburban nation. That happened first in California. That means people are much more sensitive to taxes, especially property taxes. Those are the taxes they can affect, thanks to an earlier California equilibrium upset, namely the progressive era. They can do that through the referendum. And, you know, from that tax revolt grows the Reagan Revolution, and going into next year's election, George Bush's strongest argument among many people will be, you can do better with your money than the government can do. And, you know, very few of us would deny that. So American politics has remained. In the 19th century, it had this seismic effect, fatal effect, you could say. In the 20th century, the effect has been more ambiguous, because the revolt against taxes is not really necessarily a revolt of the haves. It's also the votes of the barely haves, who are just fed up with taxes.
So, Joan Didion, on balance, are we happy that those settlers crossed the Rockies and plunged into this state? Jack Beatty presents it almost as an albatross.
No, I mean, I personally am happy.
I'm exaggerating, Jack, but you take my point.
And it's an interesting thing. People in California don't really think of themselves as part of the rest of the country at some level. History began with California. As a child, the Civil War was never really real to me, because by the time the Civil War took place, my family was already in California. They weren't in it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to learn it as it was like European history to me. New England has the same quality. I mean, it's as if the imaginative attachment to the rest of the country is rather low.
Something old and far away. Jack mentioned slouching towards Bethlehem. You wrote in that great book, you wrote, California is a place in which a boom mentality and a sense of Chekhovian loss meet in uneasy suspension, in which the mind is troubled by some buried but ineradicable suspicion that things had better work out here, because here, beneath that immense bleached sky, is where we run out of continent. That was some years ago, Joan Didion. So have things worked out? And if they haven't, what does that mean for the country?
Well, I don't know what it means for the country. What it means for for Californians. I don't think things have worked out in one way. California is still for people all over the world a very magnetic place. The idea of starting over has a lot of attraction. It's not until you don't start out asking yourself what you are starting over for, and for a while. I mean, it's still
first, it's
very
just the pleasure of the release, the freedom, the being.
It's still for people who just arrive there. I have never known anyone to come to California and settle there who wasn't. I have known people who are very resistant to it, but. On the whole, the idea of arriving in California is very, very seductive and liberating. And it's later you start wondering what you were supposed to be doing, why you were there.
And in a sense, in slouching towards Bethlehem, you were saying, If the U.S. experiment, the American experiment, is ever going to work out, it should be here. I mean, this is not only the end of the geographic expanse, but it had all this good fortune.
Well, I think I was probably still thinking of America as America had been for my family, mm-hmm. a place where people constantly moved on. I was still working on some kind of Turner thesis.
Mm-hmm. West, move, move.
Yeah, it wasn't, I mean, so... The idea of running out of continent was very frustrating to me. To look at the Pacific has always been a tremendously emotional thing because it was the end of America.
But not the end of yearning for another place to move. You quote your mother saying to your father that she would move to Australia in a minute. And he says, you don't mean that, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
She said, yes, I would, in a minute.
She was the pure strain. I mean, she was a definite mover.
Courtney's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Courtney, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom
sure.
and Joan. I'm a California expatriate living in King Arthur's Court here in Boston, and I'd like to speak to what I thought of living in California, what to me represents California, and how it shaped my life.
Please,
certainly the hope and the sort of the new society feeling of the '60s, Jerry Brown, Governor Moonbeam. A virtually free public education of that time, the big '60s explosion, and I guess I always sort of had that image that's what California was. But of course, recently I've felt that I'm sort of in a holding pattern, thinking about going back there, going back to San Francisco and seeing what it's like now and seeing all the homelessness around, people walking around. Market Street. It's like almost like a refugee city right now.
So does that leave you thinking, like Joan Didion, that there's some fundamental flaw in the kind of mythology, the self-perception of California, or not quite?
I think it's there. I don't think it's ever going to be lost, but I think it needs to be. I think it's going to eventually, I hope, that it's going to be recaptured, that the progressive direction. And it also represents the paradise lost in this whole country. I mean, it symbolizes to some extent the way that our whole country has lost its direction.
Courtney, we've got it. Let us pick it up, because Joan Didion, you speak to this paradise lost notion repeatedly throughout your new memoir.
Well, one of the things that has been most troubling to me about California is it used to have this great university, and it still does have a great university, but it's not funding it. At the levels it's being funded now, it will be degraded. And the public school system has been degraded. They used to have very good public schools, so the willingness to invest in the future seems not to be there.
But what about the idea of paradise lost? Was it a paradise, or was that always a glimmer just over the hill?
Well, there's no reason it couldn't have been a paradise. I mean, there's no reason it couldn't have been a very, 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 it was, I think, for a minute, a very good place to live.
But you're mocking in your memoir almost, Joan Didion, of artists, for example, Bierstadt and, what's his name, Thomas,
Kincaid,
who paint these very misty, pearly renditions of California that looks kind of like Disneyfied landscape. You quote Mark Twain harumphing and snorting at that hyped up
Bierstadt,
which is to say, not quite as pearly and paradise-like as people might have liked to think or portray.
Well, there was a wish to sentimentalize. A lot of the commissions that Bierstadt had, for example, from one of the people who built the Southern Pacific, a lot of the commissions he had encouraged that kind of sentimentalizing.
Even repainting, if I got you correctly, the valley where the Donner Party met its sad end to make it look lustrous and charming.
He did that for the Southern Pacific.
Jack, California has always invited that kind of romantification.
Yes, and of course, how fitting that the Dream Factory, Hollywood, should be there. Its dreams have been the coinage of the place, but also there's been the undertone, really, of the of people having reached that edge of the continent. In despair that the American dream hasn't worked out for them. I mean, you see it in Nathaniel West, memorably, Day of the Locust, where there's a kind of riot of people who are just hopeless. They're at the edge of the continent, and they're afraid they're going to fall off.
We're talking tonight with Joan Didion about her new memoir, Where I Was From. It's a personal reconsideration of her native state, California. You can join the conversation. How does the new Joan Didion view illuminate the California recall vote? And have you operated under heroic illusions about California or not? Is your bubble already burst? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with celebrated essayist and novelist Joan Didion about her personal reconsideration of her native state, California, about the myth and reality of California. You can join the conversation. What does California stand for to you today? What do you hear in the reassessments of native daughter Joan Didion and her new memoir, Where I Was From? And what is the importance of dealing forthrightly with the real bedrock of a state, of a nation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm thinking of many things, and one of them is thinking of Woody Guthrie, after the last thoughts about, California is the Garden of Eden, the paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, there's you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the
do re mi.
Well, that makes a big difference.
Having the do re mi, having the money.
Yeah, and also thinking that everything comes there first, to California, and so the big black bad side of things is going to hit there first too, maybe. Thinking of all the breast cancer and the brain tumors and the leukemia that come as the side effects of the wireless revolution. I saw a very good video, DNA, Democracy, and the Wireless Revolution.
So you're thinking that even the Internet, when it goes wireless, maybe California production that occurs.
Right. The cable doesn't kill you. But unfortunately, wirelessness does. I've been researching this matter for about 10 years, not wanting to have
So maybe yet another barbed offering from California. And thanks for calling. Joan Didion, this sense that California is first and that it's dangerous, does that line up with your contemplation?
No, I never thought it was first. When I was living out there, people were always calling me up to do magazine pieces, which depended on your believing that
Right. Everything
started in California. Mm-hmm. I never believed that. I thought stuff more about America was coming up off the interface with Latin America. I started feeling that right after the Kennedy assassination. So I never felt California was the harbinger for what the rest of the country would become.
But you do present a picture of California that at some moments has an echo of the California as the nation's loose screw. That's putting it very broadly. But you've got this a wonderful passage I wonder if you'd read for us about the kinds that refers to the kind of sacrifices of state of mind that women in your family over the generations in California had to make and how it left them in some ways vulnerable. I wonder if you could read a bit of that for us, Joan, didn't you?
These women in my family would seem to have been pragmatic and in their deepest instincts clinically radical, given to breaking clean with everyone and everything they knew. They could shoot and they could handle stock, and when their children outgrew their shoes, they could learn from the Indians how to make moccasins. Quote, an old lady in our wagon train taught my sister to make blood pudding, unquote, Narcissa Cornwall recalled. Quote, after killing a deer or steer, you cut its throat and catch the blood. You add suet to this and a little salt and meal and flour if you have it, and bake it. If you haven't anything else to eat, it's pretty good. Unquote. They tended to accommodate any means in pursuit of an uncertain end. They tended to avoid dwelling on just what that end might imply. When they could not think what else to do, they moved another 1,000 miles, set out another garden. Beans and squash and sweet peas from seeds carried from the last place. The past could be jettisoned, children buried, parents left behind, but the seeds got carried. These women in my family, without much time for second thoughts, without much inclination toward equivocation. And later, when there was time or inclination, there developed a tendency, which I came to see as endemic, toward slight and major derangements, apparently eccentric pronouncements, opaque bewilderment and moves to places not quite on the schedule.
Joan Didion, reading from her new memoir, Where I Was From, Slight and Major Derangements. What is that? Are you saying
they kind of lost focus?
Because of the demands of this endless motion that you're writing about, because of surrendering detail to just whatever it took to get on to the next place?
I think the thing that is most troubling is I think the most damaging thing in that movement was nobody ever asked what it was for. It was simply movement.
To strike it rich? Wasn't it to have a new grub stake, a big piece of land?
But for what? I mean, to what end? If you were, if you were, I mean, if you were, it did not have a, I think people were troubled by the lack of, by a purposelessness in their lives.
More so, I mean, if you ask that question, to what end? Is it more applicable to California than to the entire nation? I mean, a lot of the nation is based on building a better life and everything that that suggests in American lore.
Yeah, but there are, in much of the country, there's a much more rooted kind of life. You do have family. You do have attachments to neighbors, to other people in the community. We're talking here about people who kept giving that up.
Joan Didion writes in her new memoir, "We Americans therefore showed in early California new failings and new strength. We exhibited a novel degree of carelessness and over-hastiness, an extravagant trust in luck, a previously unknown blindness to our social duties, and an indifference to the rights of foreigners, whereof we cannot be proud." Stephen's calling from Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I just want to make sure. I've just moved to Boston from Los Angeles, and I lived in California for about 35 years.
It's a long time.
And I'm 35 years old. I was born in San Diego.
Okay.
I wanted to make the comment that Didion is definitely one of the writers amongst contemporary explicators of the space of California, similar to James Ellroy or Mike Davis. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that everybody talks about California from a very removed perspective.
Joan Didion, now from New York.
Exactly. And I think there's some underlying reasons for that. I think California is an extremely difficult place to live. And I think it's to understand it, especially from a literary perspective, there needs to be a sense of removal. And I'm definitely going through that moving to Boston. And there is a serious culture shock. And I'm sure that gives quite a bit of...
Are you missing California then, Stephen, or seeing it in a new light, or both?
I'm not missing California one bit. It seems to me that the space is really on a track that is completely out of control. And, you know, the comments were just made that there's a real lack of community, a lack of weight to the space. And that, over a long period of time, is incredibly troubling, and what's happening right now with the recall is quite stunning.
Stephen, thanks for calling. Joan Didion, a space without weight. Advise us. You sit in New York now and look west. California is part of our big family here. What can we do for it and with it?
When I moved to New York, which was in 1988, I missed it so much that I immediately agreed to do a letter from Los Angeles, from the New Yorker, I mean, a series of them, and I would go out there, and I kind of would just drive around and talk to people, and so I was not really living anywhere. I mean, I had an apartment here, and I stayed in hotels there, but I liked to encourage the notion that I hadn't really moved. Mm. And finally, I kind of adjusted. But it was for me a strangely seductive place. It was, I mean, so beautiful, which I wasn't even thinking about when I lived there.
And yet, so deep in your bones.
There's an interesting thing about the recall. I mean, we usually think of Proposition 13 as the grandfather, which was the tax thing in the 70s, as the grandfather of the recall. But it actually, Prop 13 began as a reform movement. I mean, not only in that it was a proposition, which was the whole structure of that it was set into motion by Hiram Johnson and the reform, but Prop 13 itself was supposed to clean up the assessment of property, was supposed to remove the possibility of corruption, and it had that element, but it went wrong.
And maybe some things since that. Joan Didion, there's so much more We could hear so much more in your book that we've enjoyed, and so much we've learned from you over the years. We thank you for all of it and for the new memoir, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Joan Didion, author of the new memoir, Where I Was From, all about California. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, 11th hour campaigning in the California recall race. Jack Beatty, please stand by. This is On Point. With just hours to go until California voters take to the polls, gubernatorial recall candidates are stumping across the state tonight, getting out their final messages before the vote. Governor Gray Davis, Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante, and Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger turned up the political heat today in this last day of campaigning. Here are some sounds from California today.
We need to do it for our families, don't we? We need to do it for all those workers who are not being paid the proper wages. We need to do it for all those families who are not getting health care benefits.
Hey, Arnold, what do you say? How many women have you grown?
Are all 15 women and their families lying? Or is Mr. Schwarzenegger not telling us the truth?
There's a lot of powerful enemies out there. And they are, of course, you know, striking out and trying to now derail the campaign. And I'm not going to let them derail the campaign because I'm focused on one thing, and this is October 7th.
I've known this man for 26 years, married to him for 17. He's an extraordinary father, a remarkable husband, a terrific human being.
I think he's the man, and we need a change, and he's the perfect one, so... I'm tired of all the old stuff. He hasn't been in politics, but he knows about them, so I think he'll do it.
And he's a groper. He doesn't respect women. We want someone who respects women. He should be setting an example for people of the state. And I just, the whole thing's a joke.
If this had gone on with my daughter, it wouldn't have taken a campaign to resolve it.
I believe Mr. Schwarzenegger should deal with these accusations in detail, not through... partial explanations, evasive answers, and partial denials.
Gray Davis has terminated jobs. Gray Davis has terminated dreams. Gray Davis has terminated opportunities, and now it is time that we terminate him.
The voices of California Governor Gray Davis, Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante, Republican candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger, his wife Maria Shriver, and some California voters... Jack Beatty, that is one right California stew out there.
It sure is. The headline of Maureen Dowd's column yesterday was, Win One for the Groper. You know, you'd never know it because Gray Davis didn't tell the voters in his last election, but presiding over a pretty progressive legislature, in 4 years, he created the first paid family leave program in the country, binding arbitration for state farm workers, far stricter fuel efficiency standards than the federal government. He provided for stem cell research, renewable energy, on and on and on. Of course, Gray Davis never told the voters because he's afraid of offending anyone. He and Cruz Bustamante are, to me, caricatures of the failure of public men. More feeble characters, it would be hard to imagine. And, you know, to be in public life, you have a certain burden to be vigorous, to stand up and say something. And these men, certainly Davis, throughout his career, has just been a caricature of just the opposite. You know, caution. Well, his caution is going to get him thrown out of office, I think.
He's up against Hollywood vigor in
He sure is. Oh, Tom.
The Terminator. Well, we'll see it all play out tomorrow. Jack, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.